Tolstoy and Enlightenment. The subject of Sir Isaiah Berlin's Hermann Uhl lecture, sponsored by the Pen Club, which he gave recently in London, was Tolstoy's great dislike of conventional education. This recording, made at the time, has been shortened for broadcasting.
Let me read you something which was said by the Russian radical critic Mikhailovsky, writing in the beginning of the 80s of the last century. He said, "Two things are always said about Tolstoy, that he is an outstanding writer of fiction and a bad thinker. This has become an axiom needing no illustration." Mikhailovsky was one of the very few critics of his time or of any time to challenge this verdict. This is the classical verdict which has stood above the name of Tolstoy for at least 100 years. And Mikhailovsky, in a very interesting and, I think, untranslated essay, unjustly ignored, called The Right Hand and the Left Hand of Leo Tolstoy, written in the early 80s, tries to argue that Tolstoy's penetration into ideas is at least as great as that into character and motive, and makes a very good case. Well, I won't try and summarize Mikhailovsky's argument, but what among the things which he says, and I think says very justly, is that what gave Tolstoy this reputation was that he failed to answer his own questions. I think he was probably right, Mikhailovsky, in supposing that Tolstoy was one of those extraordinary figures, very difficult to classify, with a very great power of direct vision, and asked very devastating, simple, exaggeratedly crude questions, to which the answers were not always necessarily true, sometimes exaggerated, but they were always questions of a type which neither he nor anyone else since his day has been able fully to answer. And that is why they have a peculiarly subversive and worrying tendency. In this respect, a thinker like Pascal, like Machiavelli, like Rousseau, like the author of the Book of Job, what they have in common is that they ask these appalling questions, which then linger and torture the imagination of mankind. Their answers are sometimes false and sometimes dubious, never wholly satisfactory, but the questions linger on. This particular power on the part of Tolstoy of asking these very simple and very unanswerable questions is, I think, what worried his contemporaries most and gave him a reputation, an undeserved reputation, for being a nihilist, which is what, for example, Vauguer calls him. Well, if that means that Tolstoy had the intention of destroying, it isn't true. He was not deliberately destructive in any way, he wished to create. But it is perfectly true that men with very direct vision are very devastating, and the effect of their words is often exceedingly disruptive and annihilating. And I think it was so in the case of Tolstoy. His ideas, in a certain sense, were very simple. They had something in common with the 18th century, they had something in common with our century, they had very little common with his own. He believed that the truth could be discovered by direct, simple vision. He thought, as people who believed in natural law thought, that all the answers to all questions could be discovered, provided you were in the right frame of mind. That once these answers, once discovered, remained true forever. He believed that all talk about the evolution of knowledge, or the relativity of knowledge, or that what was true in one generation was not true in the next, was some form of charlatanism. He believed that the truth was simple, permanent, direct, the same for all men, in all places, at all times. From this belief, he never swerved. He believed it at the age of 25, and he believed it at the age of 80. He did, to some extent, alter his mind about what was true. He did change his mind about what he thought was good and bad, what was right and wrong. What he did not change his mind about was about the methods of the discovery of these things. It's exceedingly difficult to classify him, particularly in his own time. There were two great movements in his time to which people try to attribute him, the famous movements called the movement of the Westernizers and the movement of the Slavophils. He belonged, as might be expected, to neither wing. The Westerners, as people know, believed in progress, science, reason, the ripest fruits of civilization, the application of technological knowledge to life. They condemned superstition, prejudice, tradition, every form of mystical, supernatural source of knowledge, and so forth. In fact, they were Western radicals. Tolstoy agreed with them in condemning repression, inequality, arbitrary violence, but he detested all his life what he regarded as the false values of scientists, liberals, parliamentarians. is on the whole took exactly the same view of intellectuals as, for example, Rousseau, whom he read all his life and admired all his life. He taught them a small elite of self-deceived persons, vain, self-segregated from the people, remote, with the sources of feeling dried, arid, arrogant, unable to place themselves in a position where the truth might appear clear to them. A small, self-appointed, corrupt elite, seeking to dominate people by claiming expertise in moral and political questions. For Tolstoy, the very notion of the fact that there could be experts in moral and political questions was automatically a falsehood. Every man was an expert in morals. Every man was an expert on how to live and what to do. They might get the answer wrong, but there was no special training. There was no such thing as a technique for the discovery of these central and important truths. That is again a proposition which he derived certainly from Rousseau and perhaps from thinkers before Rousseau, in respect of which he shares some of the convictions of the 18th century. And he condemned the intellectual elites precisely for those reasons. Education for him ruins the condition in which we see the truth. That condition is innocence. Innocence is what children and peasants possess, and what mature, civilized adults in sophisticated and corrupt societies notably do not possess. That is why the education which these corrupt adults try to instill in the innocent children is resisted by the children, resisted very vigorously and passionately. So that the children have to be educated quite often against their wills. The truth, for Tolstoy, can never be resisted by man who is made by God to imbibe and absorb it. Therefore, if the children resist, it's because they feel the kind of truths that are poured into them to be some sort of poison, which is deleterious to their systems. Therefore, instead of continuing to violate these children and impose false values upon them, which derive from our decadent civilization, we must, on the contrary, try and discover the genuine truth, the kind of doctrine which any human being is made by nature to imbibe without that natural resistance which comes about from trying to resist what is harmful to our systems. For this reason, he detested doctrine, theory, intellectualism of any kind. His attitude towards it was that, like that of Rousseau, like that of Dickens, whom of all authors in the 19th century he admired most. Progressives was always the word of abuse which he used for doctrinaires. These persons must be prized off the people's necks, and they must be prized off the children's necks. Otherwise they will create a tyranny under which humanity will grow. You might think in this that he would perhaps incline towards the other wing of the great Russian political scene, namely the Slavophils. Well, of course, in a sense he did. He was a landowner by prejudice and by, so to speak, temperament. He liked the land, he liked tradition, he liked peasants. He thought even the village priest was something better than a sophisticated German educator, because the village priest was ignorant, he was idle, he was stupid, but he was a human being. He treated other people as human beings. He might treat them. He might perhaps not be altogether conscientious in discharge of his duties. He was ignorant. But these were human natural vices, far better than the appalling, sophisticated, induced, corrupt vices of a more sophisticated kind of culture. Nevertheless, he wasn't a Slavophil either. He didn't accept the Slavophil notion of the great mystical body of the nation, or of the people, perhaps not the nation, but the great Russian Orthodox society. The great union of the past, the present, and the future, the great mystical Christian body in which the individual was only a limb. He rejected with a specifically 18th century kind of chilly rationalism the whole Slavophil myth about the fact that the people is wiser than its members, about the necessity of faith in history and in tradition, about the fact that each society, in particular Russian society, has a sacred mission imposed upon it by God to regenerate itself and mankind. These things appear to him to be perverted forms of Hegelian nonsense. There is no body of men for whom he reserves a more withering scorn than German metaphysicians, whom he regarded as on the whole responsible for these kind of doctrines on the part of his Russian neighbors. Nevertheless, temperamentally, he liked them best. He visited their houses. They did at least possess a certain natural consciousness of what a peasant was like. They had a certain contact with the soil. In short, he was a man who temperamentally was deeply conservative and deeply traditionalist, but in intellect was exceedingly rationalistic, cold, skeptical, and analytical. And these things created a kind of tension and a kind of opposition within him, which lingered all his life and is responsible both for his best and his worst pages. He shared with the French philosophers of the 18th century extreme distaste for what he regarded as merely traditional disciplines. He thought the classical curriculum absurd. He thought the idea of pumping dead languages into children, some kind of idiotic error, idiotic fallacy, self-blinding, a kind of dogmatic trust in the meaningless tradition which schoolmasters possessed simply because they didn't have the originality or the honesty to realize how little good it did. He disliked theology. He thought that history was a good subject if only it answered the questions we really wanted answered. But, he said, the actual history which one read dealt with questions of utmost triviality which couldn't occupy any serious person. We didn't want to know what the name was of the fourth wife of Ivan the Terrible. We didn't want to know what snake bit Oleg. These are quotations. History, he said, was like a deaf man answering questions which nobody had asked. And for that reason, he condemned these subjects in a very positivist sort of way, exactly the way in which people like Holbach and Helvetius in the 18th century condemned it as being useless for a practical life, no good to people who wanted to know what to do and how to live. These were approximately his ideas, even as a young man. You will see that he didn't alter them so very much when he grew older. All these ideas, all these tensions, all these contradictions came out in his educational tracts, which is what I propose to talk to you about. These are things not often discussed, usually dismissed as mere fads on the part of a great novelist, mere caprice on the part of an otherwise great man. But I think there's more to be said about them and for them than that. I think Michalowski was perfectly right. I should like you to take a look at Tolstoy in 1860, which is when he wrote these educational tracts. He was then 32. He was regarded as a very promising writer. He hadn't written very much. He had written the stories about the Crimean War, called the Sebastopol Sketches. He had written this autobiographical novel, which is called Childhood, Adolescence, and Youth, which is a masterpiece, and the masterpiece called The Cossacks. He was very much taken up by the literary set, of the progressive literary set in Russia, that is to say, by people like Turgenev, Nekrasov, Pisemsky, and others, who thought him a very talented writer, very promising, marvelously fresh, wonderful images, great originality, extraordinary power of description, very promising, barbarous Russian style, incapable of writing a good sentence. He had been corrected by every editor he used to complain to whom he sent his manuscripts, but obviously a man of the highest possible promise. At the same time, the relationship between him and these people was exceedingly uneasy. They were on the whole Westerners, and they knew that he rejected what might be called their secular and radical values. But it lay deeper than that. It wasn't just a question of division of opinion. As a person, he didn't fit. He went to the salons, the right-wing and left-wing salons, both. They were both in those days, too. But he was too much of an officer for them. He was too aristocratic, too vehement, in a way, too formidable, in a society which prided itself on its extreme capacity for talking very freely and making endless confessions to one another, for opening one's heart. He was reserved, he was ironical, he was disagreeable at times, he had a bad temper, he was came from a society which was at once grander than theirs and simpler. A more aristocratic society, he was too much an officer. It's true that he no longer gambled, he no longer spent his wild nights with the gypsies, he was married, he was in love with his wife, he had settled down. Nevertheless, it is quite clear to all these men that what he wasn't was a member of, he wasn't a man of letters. He was interested in even the gypsies, even racehorses, more than he was interested in books, reviews, critics, the quarrels of critics, all the paraphernalia, so to speak, all professional literary life. They didn't interest him in the least. And he was not only not interested, he was contemptuous of it. And they felt that he was a kind of disdainful outsider, with a private life of his own which he didn't show, which went on inside him, and which had far more in common with the enemy class, the class of the aristocratic officers who did gamble all night and go to the gypsies and had reactionary views. And in some temperamental way, he was more akin to these, had a greater affinity than he did to the liberal world of the Moscow literateurs who looked to the West and wanted to regenerate society. I think really fundamentally, this is what went wrong between them. Well, he felt the same, and in the end, couldn't really go on with that society. He treated them, he tried to make friends with them, but he constantly had rows. The biggest was Turgenev, which was well known. They treated him in a kind of nervous respect for a man of genius who was not one of us. They felt something alien, something hostile. At any rate, he left this particular circle, drifted away, went back to his estates, Like all young men of good birth and money, he was conscience-stricken by the peasants, whose appalling condition lay just as heavily on his conscience as anybody else's of that type. And he thought that above all, one must stop talking, one must stop writing. These were activities of Moscow intellectuals, Petersburg intellectuals, scribblers. One must do something. He was by nature a man of action. He liked describing action. He had contempt for what might be called the life of contemplation, particularly the life of secular contemplation, literary contemplation. And so he decided that he must do something about education, that after all, anyone could lead a good life if they knew the truth. They must know the truth by finding out what the relevant facts, studying nature, studying life, studying perhaps sacred books, studying something which would give you the evidence on which sound conclusions about how to live could be reached. It was a period of one of his crises, and he decided then that he couldn't remain in Russia, he would go abroad and study all the fashionable doctrines of education which were going on in other countries. Russia was, after all, an ignorant, backward country, and perhaps in France, or in Germany, or in England, there might be interesting theories of education which he might pick up for the purpose of doing something for the peasants on his own land. He went abroad, and he went to England first, I think, and discovered nothing in England at all. He said the English system of education was extremely antiquated and of no possible interest to any man who took an interest in education. He then, from England, travelled to France. France was also a disappointment in its own way. France was a disappointment because he said they were too mechanical. They did work very hard, but unfortunately they didn't really absorb very much. He said that prepared, he went round to schools. What he intended to do was to ask for letters of introduction, which he got quite easily, and he asked the schoolboys questions just to see what education had done to them. And he then went to France, and he found that the learning there was too mechanical. It was all by rote. Lists of dates, for example, he got got good answers on, because the children learned them by heart. But the same children, when he asked them exactly the same facts from some new or unexpected angle, produced idiotic replies. He said this showed their knowledge meant nothing to them. For example, one schoolboy replied that the murderer of Henry IV of France was Julius Caesar. And this appeared to be absolutely typical. He thought it was perfectly characteristic he didn't happen to have learned this particular answer by heart. However, the home of theory was not France. The home of theory was Germany. And so he went to Germany with the highest possible hopes. He came home bitterly disappointed and indeed very angry. And in a journal, which is called Jasna Palana, which was the name of his estate, which he printed at his own expense and distributed among various persons to whom it caused either amusement or irritation, he had very few admirers, he gave a very amusing account, as good in a way as anything which has been found in the novels afterwards, of German system, this German pedagogical system, the German system of education at his during his time. I'll try and read you a passage from this. It's really a very hair-raising description. He went to one of the schools where the latest method of teaching the alphabet was employed, which had been taught to the schoolmaster by one of the most advanced German teachers' seminaries. He describes the pedantic, immensely self-satisfied schoolmaster as he enters the room and notes with approval that the children are seated at their desks, crushed and obedient, in total silence, as prescribed by German rules of education and German rules of behavior. Now let me quote a passage from Tolstoy. This is the schoolmaster. He casts a look round the class, and he already knows what it is that the boys ought to understand. He knows this, and he knows exactly what the children's souls are made of, too. And he knows a great deal else than the seminary has told him. He is armed with the latest and most progressive pedagogic volume, which is called Das Fischbuch, the fish book. It contains pictures of a fish. Then a dialogue begins, which Tolstoy describes. The schoolmaster stands in front of the school children, and he says to them, "What is this, dear children?" "A fish," replies the brightest. "No, no, think, think," says the schoolmaster. And the schoolmaster will not rest until some child says that what they see is not a fish at all, but a book. That's much better. "And what do books contain?" "Letters," says the brightest boy. "No, no," says the schoolmaster sadly. "You really must think of what you are saying." By this time, the children, according to Tolstoy, are becoming hopelessly demoralized. They have no idea of what they're meant to say. All they have is that they have a confused feeling, says Tolstoy, a confused feeling which is perfectly correct so far as it goes, that the schoolmaster wants them to say something absolutely unintelligible. He wants them to say that in some sense a fish is not a fish. They feel whatever it is that the schoolmaster wants them to say is something they will never think of. These children's thoughts begin to stray. they can't keep their, obviously can't preserve their attention. They begin to wonder, and that's very Tolstoy, and it could have occurred in any of his novels, the children begin to wonder why the master is wearing spectacles. Why the master is looking through the spectacles instead of taking them off, and that kind of thing. The master urges them to concentrate. He harries them and he tortures them, until he manages to make them say that what they see is not a fish, but a picture. And then after more torture, then the picture represents a fish. If that's what he wants them to say, says Tolstoy, if that's all he wants them to say, wouldn't it be easier to make them learn this piece of profound wisdom by heart, instead of tormenting them with this idiotic fish book method, which so far from causing them to think creatively, which is the German doctrine, merely stupefies them. The genuinely intelligent children know perfectly well that their answers will always be wrong. They can't tell why. All they know is this is so. While the stupid children, who occasionally by pure fluke provide the right answer, have no idea why they're being praised. All the German pedagogue is doing, says Tolstoy, is to feed dead human material, or rather living human beings, into an enormous, grotesque mechanical contraption, invented by fanatical fools, who think that this is the way of applying scientific method to the education of live human beings. This is exactly the parallel to this is Tolstoy's passages in War and Peace, where he talks about German strategists and so forth, who think that they can make troops or human beings go through certain mechanical or geometrical evolutions, and in this way win victories. In other words, the notion that you can apply some kind of abstract doctrine or pattern to the confused mass of living human flesh. Tolstoy assures us, this is account of the fish book and so on, of which I've only given you a very short extract, he is not a parody, but a faithful representation of what he saw and heard in the most advanced schools in Germany. And, as he adds, in a little acid footnote, and also in those schools in England that have been fortunate enough to acquire these wonderful modern methods. Disillusioned and indignant, he returned to his estate, and he began to teach the village children himself. He built schools, he continued to study, to reject and to denounce current doctrines. He published periodicals, he published pamphlets. He invented new methods of learning geography, zoology, physics. He composed an entirely new manual of arithmetic, according to some method of his own. He inveighed against all methods of forcing children, especially those which consisted in making children against their will to memorize facts, dates, figures. In fact, he behaved exactly like an 18th century eccentric person. He behaved like an original, enlightened, energetic, opinionated, eccentric landowner in the 18th century who had become a convert to the doctrines of Rousseau or the Abbé Mably. Russia, in certain respects, was perhaps 100 years behind Europe in this respect, and this kind of 18th century behavior shouldn't really astonish anybody. Well, he taught these children, and in the course of teaching these children, he wrote some very extraordinary pages, because you see, what he does is, he describes the school, and then he describes little walks which he takes with the children in the woods. And some of those marvelous pages of description in Tolstoy are in these pamphlets. I don't think they've been translated into English, I think some perhaps have been, but certainly not all. Some of the most magnificent, evocative, descriptive prose that even Tolstoy, the greatest master of it in some ways, ever wrote, comes in these very touching pages in which he gives a full description of himself with the children, how they walk in the woods, the questions he asks, what the children answer, how he asks them further questions, and so forth. And always is the same refrain. One mustn't interfere with these children. They are by nature better than we adults. When he sets them to write exercises, he at least affects to say that the things which they produce, for example, little descriptions of their parents, or little descriptions of their lives, are far not only simpler, not only more beautiful, but far profounder, far grander, far more impressive than any of the works of Schiller or Goethe, let alone Shakespeare, whom he rated, as we know, very low. You see, it's very extraordinary. These accounts are very compounded of three elements, these stories by Tolstoy. On the one hand, marvelous description of nature, the woods at night, the children walking himself with them. Secondly, extracting the children's exercises, which appear not at all wonderful to us, but which appear to him to be the absolute magic of creation which he was privileged to attend. He says what humility possessed him when he felt that at last he was present at the divine act of creation which a corrupt and sophisticated being like himself would never, never attain. And on top of all this, there is all this doctrine about simplicity, about anti-sophistication, about all kinds of 18th century dogmata derived from reading 18th century authors or derived from his own mind, which doesn't quite mix with the marvelous natural descriptions, but is rather like a sort of crisscross window with a sort of rigid pattern through which nevertheless we do see living nature. And his enormous vitality as a writer somehow manages to fuse all this into one extraordinary single united whole, so that reading it is a genuine pleasure. These are among the most creative pages that even Tolstoy ever wrote.
those were his educational experiments. Not very many pupils, there were some pupils who survived, who did indeed say that they enjoyed being taught by Tolstoy very much, but so far as the later careers of these pupils are concerned, not one of them certainly became either a creative writer or anything else that was notable at all. But I dare say they enjoyed themselves in the process. Exactly the same idea really penetrates Tolstoy's views of aesthetics. I don't know how many people here have read the famous introduction to the translation of the story by Maupassant, whom Tolstoy admired very greatly. But that lays down criteria of what, for example, makes good art. And in a way, you will find exactly the same idea. Harmony versus sophistication. Simplicity versus complexity. Nature versus theory, dogma, doctrine, and so forth, comes out there too. And above all, simple emotion, direct vision of life, desire to find the good, versus all kinds of doctrinal points of view, theories, attempts at objectivity, attempts at disinterestedness, all of which he believed to be mistaken and false. The three criteria of art, which you probably know well, are these. First, you must be able to know how to write. Secondly, you must have a subject which is worthy of being written about. Large enough, human enough, grand enough, important enough. Thirdly, you must have a proper attitude towards the subject. You must really love what you love and hate what you hate and not pretend to do it, or above all, try and behave as if you were disinterested or objective, which is in any case impossible, because everyone must have a moral point of view. And he gives marks to various writers accordingly. For example, Turgenev gets very good marks for being a good writer, and he gets quite good marks for being on genuine terms with the subject. He really is interested in what he's writing about. The trouble about him is all the subjects which Turgenev treats appear to Tolstoy to be superficial, trivial, not worth writing about. The affairs of ladies and gentlemen of society who live in the superficies of life and who don't plunge, who are not the kind of human beings, or at least not represented by Turgenev as the kind of human beings, who really represent what is valuable, what is important, what is eternal in man. The poet Nekrasov gets very good marks for the importance of his subject because he writes about the oppressed and the poor, and good marks for writing about frustrated idealists and suffering peasants. He's also thought to be a very good writer. What is wrong with him is that his attitude towards the subject is perfectly unreal and chilly, that in fact he's in some sense bogus, that he pretends to suffer when he doesn't suffer, sheds tears when he has no tears, and that the whole thing is rather ultimately a piece of insincere virtuosity. Dostoevsky gets marks for seriousness, and he gets marks for seriousness about his subject and the importance of the subject, but says Tolstoy, unfortunately, he can't write. He's verbose, he's undisciplined, he says everything in the first 150 pages, and the remaining 600 pages are a mere repetition of this in various fashions, perhaps because he was a poor man and had to write magazines, he adds. But, at any rate, those are the kinds of judgments. Very, very rigid, very 18th century, exactly like someone like Boileau, exactly like someone like the Abbé Batteux. There are these rules, you apply them, and you get the result. The puzzling case is the case of Maupassant. Because Maupassant, he adored, he thought him a wonderful writer and very immoral. And this created a certain problem. And his point about Maupassant is that, of course, Maupassant has false doctrines. Maupassant thinks, for example, that one should amuse people, or one should produce works of art. It's not at all the business of a writer to produce works of art. The business of a writer is to tell the truth. And if you tell the truth clearly and well, the result will be a work of art. But, says Tolstoy, genius is the capacity for insight into life. And because genius is a capacity for insight into life, Maupassant has genius, can't help seeing the truth, although he tries not to. But because he's a genius, the truth will out, and he's a kind of Balaam. He comes to curse, but he stays to bless. He can't help it. He can't help it because talent is vision. And that is why, ultimately, he gets good marks, so to speak. He gets good marks for penetrating into the essence of things. It's true and very sad that Maupassant should be on the side sometimes of the worthless Paris seducer and not at all on the side of his hapless victim. That's corruption. That's decadence. That's because he lives in France. That's because the French are a decadent people. That is because the French have long strayed from the path of virtue, because there is a lot of urban life, because there is a lot of sophistication. That is very sad and very bad. But insofar as Maupassant describes life at a certain depth, he can't help stirring in human beings those deep problems which in fact do make them ask themselves the important questions and therefore turn them to the path of virtue. And that is a function of all men of genius, whatever they may think they're doing. If they are geniuses, they see the truth, they communicate the truth, and once the truth is communicated, it saves men. That is the defense, and a very curious, and a very very paradoxical, and very original defense that Maupassant it certainly is. What Maupassant may have thought about it all is not known. They dislike it. They cannot understand it, that's why they dislike it. What is truly great is what is truly universally intelligible. Everyone knows this particular doctrine. The Bible is intelligible. The Iliad is intelligible. Folk song is intelligible. Mozart and Chopin are not intelligible. Boris Godunov and the newspapers are not intelligible. I like the Telegraph because it tells me about the health of my sister, he says. I am interested in the newspapers because it tells me about the prospects of Otto I of Greece. Because I like knowing about the prospects of Otto I in Greece. But of course I admire and respect the peasants to whom Otto I of Greece or my sister's health means absolutely nothing. And therefore, if this is what we're going to praise civilization for, its fruits are really too contemptible to be regarded as a reason for glorifying this highly corrupt civilization in which we live. If we are as corrupt as this, what right have we to teach others? Tolstoy repeats the lessons of Rousseau's Emile. Nature, nature, only nature helps. We must seek to understand what is natural, spontaneous, uncorrupted, sound, in harmony with itself, and so forth. We mustn't alter. We mustn't force into a mold. We must listen to the dictates of our own stifled original nature. Don't look at nature's raw stuff on which to impose your unique personality and your powerful will. You mustn't want to defy. You mustn't want to be Prometheus. You mustn't want to create new goals and build new worlds in competition, in rivalry, with what our moral sense knows to be eternal truths, which are given once and for all to all men. That's the monstrous sin of pride. That's what all revolutionaries, all reformers, everybody we're supposed to admire, according to history, did. That's why they're so disastrous. That's why Napoleon was such a monster and such a disaster. Education, says Tolstoy, is the action of one person on another with a view to causing the other to acquire certain moral habits. But this always involves some degree of moral tyranny. If I'm sure that I know the truth, if I'm sure that everything else is error, does that really entitle me to superintend the education of another man? Is such certainty enough? By what right do I put a wall around the pupil, exclude external influences, and try and mold him as I please into my own or into somebody else's image? If the history of education is merely the history of tyranny and of error, what right have we to carry on what he calls this abominable farce? And if we are told that it's always been so, that this is nothing new, that we can't help it, we must do our best, isn't that like saying that murders have always taken place? So that we might as well go on murdering, even though we have now discovered what it is that makes men murder. This is a very typical piece of paradoxical Tolstoyan exaggeration. This is the quietest strain. What then must we do? Do nothing is the answer. Let nature take her course. Don't interfere. Don't force people against their natural inclinations. Cultivate spontaneity. Be humble. That is one strain. The other strain is the exact opposite of this. Tolstoy sees that, as I told you before, the gentleman can't become a peasant and can't become a child. And suddenly in his essay, What is Art?, Tolstoy suddenly tells the educated reader that perhaps civilized values are not quite so absurd, not quite so meaningless as he was led to believe. Let me quote. The peasant, says Tolstoy suddenly, needs what your life of 10 generations, uncrushed by hard labor, has given you. You had the leisure to search, to think, to suffer. Then give him that for the sake of which you have suffered. He, the peasant, is in need of it. Don't bury in the earth the talent that was given to you by history. But it follows from this that leisure is not necessary, that leisure needn't be merely destructive. Progress can occur. We apparently can learn from the past, as people who live in that past couldn't. It's true, we live in an unjust order. But this in itself creates direct obligations. Those who are members of the civilized elite, cut off, of course, as they tragically are, from the masses, nevertheless have the duty to try and help broken humanity, to stop exploiting them, to give them what they most need, education, knowledge, material help, capacity for living better lives. Levin and Anna Karenina takes up where Nikolai Rostov, in War and Peace, leaves off. They're not quietists, and yet, according to Tolstoy, they do what is right. It's a very peculiar picture, that of Tolstoy in the 80s and 90s, trying to struggle with this problem. He's constantly oscillating between two poles, just as the Narodnik students were oscillating two poles. What do we do for the people? Do we give them what they want? Because they're better men than we are, in that case they'll remain in their original ignorance and poverty. Or do we give them what we want? But how can we tell that that is what is best for them? We are corrupt. Who will purify us? How can you get hold of an absolute pure educator who really will teach the truth? The truth is perhaps in the Gospels. The truth is in simple lives. How can I know that I have grasped this correctly? I, who have gone and the product of the most elaborate and most sophisticated civilization. Between these poles constantly oscillate, and indeed, between these poles a great many liberals have oscillated. This is not confined to Tolstoy. People like Chernyshevsky in Russia, people even like John Stuart Mill in England, are constantly asking themselves this painful question. Tolstoy sacrificed everything upon the altar of the truth. In a sort of curious way, he really is a martyr to the Enlightenment, martyr to the search for the empirical truth. In a curious way, his own life is a kind of paradox, because his life is a testimony against what he most passionately believed. What he believed most passionately was that the truth was simple, that the truth is clear, that the truth is given to people who simply, the truth is all around us, the truth is before our very eyes. There is no need to look in remote and dark corners for it. If only we turn our gaze upon what is most present to us, we shall see it here before us. That's what he believed. And yet, so far as his own wanderings are concerned, it looked as if the more he knew, the more uncertain he became. The deeper he dug, the more dreadfully he doubted. The more he knew, the less certain he became. And therefore, there is a kind of curious paradox about Tolstoy's whole life. That the very proposition which he sacrificed his life to maintain, both in his novels and afterwards his conversion, namely that the truth is clear and simple, is the proposition which his own life refutes most dramatically. Because if there is one thing to be gained from reading these extraordinary pages in which Tolstoy juxtaposes contradictory and irreconcilable views, it is the truth is seldom simple, it's seldom as obvious as the common man would like to believe it to be. That, I think, is what one learns from Tolstoy, and perhaps that is the only truth which we are ever likely to obtain in this matter. Perhaps it is enough.
That was a recording of the Hermann Uhland lecture which Sir Isaiah Berlin gave recently under the auspices of the Pen Club. It was shortened for broadcasting. The complete lecture will be published in the February issue of Encounter.